I'm Tim Gombas, and this is Faith Improvised. It's a podcast where I can think out loud and talk with friends about things that interest me. Books, films, sports, music, culture, politics, the wonders and complexities of being Christian in this world, and my academic discipline, biblical studies. You're welcome to email me if you like at faithimprovised@gmail.com. In this episode, Steve and I talk about a bunch of things, including what we've learned about teaching. Yeah, I stepped outside and was just like, "Oh my word, it is beautiful." I thought about actually just taking a chair out, sitting in the sun for a bit, because it's just so beautiful, and the air is crisp. It just feels so good.
Amazing. We've had a week straight of high 50s, mid 60s.
Yeah.
In February.
Yeah. Which
I just feel like I'm getting away with something. Like one less day of winter.
Oh, totally, man.
It's going to come crashing down. I mean, March, we're turning the corner. I mean, March can have its cold snaps, but man.
Yeah, I'll take it.
I'll take it.
Yeah, I'll take it instead of, 18 inches of snow or whatever. I don't even know what they're getting up north, but I'm very happy. I will take this all day long. Step outside in a hoodie.
Oh,
this is fantastic. Dude, I got to tell you about yesterday, man.
Yeah.
This is so. So I signed up yesterday to take a third grade class in the city at a school just south of the downtown. And just thought, how bad could it be? You know, it's an elementary school. Just check it out. And it was a Montessori school, which I was just ready for anything. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how Montessori it is. I don't know. I've never been in one of those. It seemed just like any other kind of school. But man, it was an adventure. I mean, it was you see up close, very obviously, you know, the economic injustice, the injustice of, you know, a place that's under resourced. Against the place, you know, that I was for several days last week, that is, you know, plenty resourced and, you know, shiny and new and all that kind of stuff. And it was interesting. Staff kept stopping me and thanking me for being there. Well, I was like, yeah, no problem, you know, whatever. But one teacher stopped me and said, like, they can't get subs. And subs get run off. She said one person, like, walked out, just, like, left, didn't even make it a whole day. I guess like the class just like went after him. I don't know if it was a man or a woman, but
yeah.
Anyway, I had so much fun. I mean, third grade is just a sweet spot. I mean, they're just fun. You can make them laugh and you can have a good time, you know, walking through math word problems and just goofing around and you know, all that kind of stuff. It's just really, it was a good time. But we went out on the, like in the middle of the day, went outside on the blacktop for recess. These kids are running around. I'm kicking, you know, balls in the air and throwing them passes and all this. I just was having so much fun. And I was out of the corner of my eye. I saw this girl walking after another girl, like with purpose, like stomping after. I was like, what is she up to? Man, she grabbed her hair, started pulling and slapping, and like a fight broke out.
I
was like, good Lord. So I ran over there, separated them, and I'm like, what are you doing? Like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
I mean, just was shocked. I'm like, what in the world is going on? So I march them over, told these two girls to sit by the wall, and you know, had this other girl separated, and another teacher came over, and anyway, they sorted it out. But this was really funny. The rest of the day, a couple of these kids are looking at me out of the corner of their eye, and I'm like, what is going on? Like, the mood of the class changed. You know, like, what's going on? And they're like, Mr. G, you said a bad word. I'm like, oh, what? I'm like, that's what's straight. I mean, these girls are going at it. I mean, I hate violence. I hate seeing that kind of stuff. It breaks my heart. It really disturbs me. Yeah. And I'm like, that's what you were, that's what struck you? I'm like, come on. How about a little teamsmanship here? So I had the whole class. I said, all right, listen up. I was breaking up a fight on the playground, told the whole class. I said, I got a little bit upset and I said a word I shouldn't have said. I'm sorry. Just, you know, they're like, okay, okay. But then, like, because they were talking with other third graders out there on the playground, and then when they gathered with the rest of the third graders to leave for the day, you know, to get picked up, they're all whispering and talking and pointing at me. it became like the talk of the third grade. Mr. G,
the cutting substitute.
I know. God, caught me some slack here, man.
Yeah,
it was
that's
so
crazy.
Funny, man. It cracked me up. Whatever. Hopefully they'll have me back sometime. I don't know.
A teacher who breaks the rules.
Yeah. I'm the radical. Jeez, that was, anyway.
They're lucky more than that didn't come out.
Oh, jeez, I know. I mean, like, you get fired up. I'm like, come on. Anyway, it was funny. It was just a very interesting experience walking in there as opposed to walking in some of these other schools. Anyway, I don't know what I'm going to
do. Well, at least you're using... I always say, at least you're using biblical curse words.
Yeah.
Hell, God,
totally.
Damn.
Come on.
Yeah, Jesus totally. Christ.
This is right out of the Bible.
Right out of the Bible.
Yeah. Dude, did you listen to Steve Sands on Tony Kornheiser?
Yeah, that was surprising.
That's pretty wild, man. That is crazy. Well, I saw some headlines on ESPN over the weekend, but I didn't realize like all that went into just the craziness at the WM championship out in Phoenix. I mean, I think is always set up to get rowdy, but and you know it's going to get out of control at some point.
Bonkers. I had seen some. I had seen a couple headlines too about. I didn't realize how. I mean, it was getting nuts.
Oh yeah.
Kind of like a rock concert or something.
Yeah.
Kind of a feeling. You know, I was thinking, you know, listening to him on Tony, Steve, gosh, he was talking about like a major kind of maybe phase shift going on in golf where they want to be more mainstream because golf's always been a gentleman's very proper, very high morals kind of game, which I like. I thought a lot about that, but that now the LIV Tour, which is sucking out massive talent out of the PGA, are going that route. They're wearing shorts when they play and fans are playing music and all of this stuff, trying to just get more kind of more like a party kind of environment. And it's just wild to think about. I mean, at the only other phase shift, which in golf that I can think about in my lifetime was the Tiger phenomenon.
Yeah.
When he really made people look at golf in a different light, like, that's a stud athlete out there, not just some gentleman hitting a ball around.
Yeah.
And man, got a lot of people, young people into golf.
Yeah. Yeah. Like an athlete instead of like, you know, I mean, back in the day before he came along, you know, guys like Fuzzy Zeller, I mean, guys are walking around with pot bellies and I mean,
cigarettes.
There was a lot of, I was going to say there were a lot of guys that just smoked on tour.
Yeah.
And like Jack Nicklaus used to back in the day and Arnie, you know, they'd carry around a cigarette cupped. You know, like in their hands, so nobody could see it if they were shown on television. Tiger came along and was like an athlete, and he made everybody change over time. But I mean, like David Duvall got in shape. A lot of guys got in shape to be able to perform like him. You're right, that was a major shift.
Mm-hmm.
But you know that's the thing that. I was thinking about that I took away from what Steve Sands was saying.
Mm-hmm.
That desire on the part of golf to attract like more sports fans, not just golf fans.
Right.
That bothers me. That because it I just don't, I really, that desire to sort of gain in popularity just bothers me. To change a thing so that more people are interested in. I mean, I know that I get it, that that's how, you know, money is made and all that kind of stuff. But again, money messes everything up. And the desire for money messes everything up. And to think that you can change a thing to sort of have more people like it. I just hate that sentiment. I hate that notion. Listening to, there's a massive difference between listening to like everyday sports talk people talk about golf and people who know golf talking about golf. There's a big difference. And it's not the case that every sports fan is going to like golf, or like if you just make the atmosphere more of a party and there's more booze and everyone's right. kind of going, getting rowdy, like it's going to be any better. It's going to just change the nature of how it's played. And right. I just can't stand that kind of sentiment. I don't, yeah. I mean, I don't like that. Like even for myself, because I don't want to be thinking in those terms, like, like the whole rationale behind just doing this podcast is it's gotta be fun for me. And that's, yeah. That's 100% of the point. I don't care. I know that I'm not for everybody. And I don't want to change to sort of appeal to more of like a bigger audience.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want, right. I wouldn't want golf to change. It's like, if you like it, you like yeah. it. If you don't, you don't. I mean, you and I watch yeah. a bunch of the bigger events. We watch the majors together. Yeah. But it's like, I don't want those to change so that no. like there's a bigger audience. I don't like that feeling or that sentiment. I don't know. I just, it's always bothered me.
Yeah. It's when you love a game for its integrity, when golf, you know, I mean, gosh, there's, I can't think of a higher like moral caliber game where, I mean,
yeah.
you call penalties on yourself.
Yeah.
But I think maybe.
Yeah. There's a big honor code associated with it. And guys yeah, who have cheated like once in their like early in their career or like in their amateur career or whatever, that's a stain that nobody ever forgets.
Right. I was thinking about a couple of sports that maybe a little bit analogous, but I mean, golf is golf. It's unique.
Yeah.
Baseball purists.
Yeah.
Is another one where it's not for everybody. It's for baseball lovers because it's a slow game. It's a long game. It's mm-hmm. a tennis, perhaps the same way.
Yeah.
And you know, in my own personal experience, I've talked to a Brazilian jiu-jitsu master. I've talked about Hickson Gracie, who's an undefeated MMA fighter. But how the UFC has been corrupted by creating a sport that has more action,
yeah,
more punches, more drama. But it started out with like wide time limits. Like you could just go, you let the fight go. And it was mm-hmm. these guys who were fighting a street style, getting people down on the ground. And it was boring. It didn't please the crowd.
Yeah.
They won the fight and they were dominant and they made people tap out, but it's like, what are they doing? They're just hanging on to each other. Well, the chess match that was going on, if you've studied the art, is incredible in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. But now they're like, they have all these time limits and it's all this, you know, crazy short times and a lot of more punching that excites people more. So it's like, you see these trends in sports and it's kind of depressing because you're like, man, the pure stuff, as I see it, and you know, I'm yeah. sure in a modern UFC fighter, I'll go, what are you talking about? That, you know, but hey, I don't know. It'd be interesting if we could go back and listen to like hear what Bobby Jones would say about what's going on in golf right now.
He never turned pro,
right?
He was an amateur golfer,
right?
I mean, because it used to be that was like an honorable thing to be. Well, I mean, obviously yeah. he's very wealthy and he's a gentleman,
right. yeah.
Gentleman golfer, won the Grand Slam as an amateur. And actually that was baseball too. Like, in that Ken Burns, thing on baseball, which is incredible. I got to go back and watch that again. He talked about, I think it was in the late, maybe the late 19th century, early 20th century. There was a massive outcry when baseball players started getting paid, when they started playing baseball as their profession to make money. Because they all worked jobs and it was like a club sport. There's something pure about amateur sports, and money was seen as a corrupting element, and it has. It's the corruption is complete because we see it as normal. Like, you should get paid. And even I just was thinking about this like a week or two ago, listening to Tony Kornheiser. I think he was talking to one of the baseball writers, and they're talking about like baseball writers now have to be masters of like contract terms and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I'm like, God, that's just so messed up. I don't want to hear about that. I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about like what's good television or whatever. It's like the game's the game. There's something beautiful about it and wonderful about it. And if you don't like it, or if people like it or don't like it, so what? Yeah, the whole made for television dynamic is just really, it bums me out.
It bums me out too. You know, they were also talking on today's episode about the Taylor Swift effect on the Super Bowl, like making tons of money. Yeah. And what's the NFL going to do if she and Travis break up?
Which will happen.
Exactly. It's like, wow, I can't even believe we're talking about this. But
I know.
Like we said on the last episode, everything comes down to money.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just follow the money. Actually, Steve Sands mentioned that today.
Yeah. The answer to all your questions is money.
Is money. So
yeah, Tony says that all the time. Well, yeah, go ahead.
In education, you know, in higher ed that we both participate in as professors, you know, I just think it's so warped that, okay, at most land-grant universities, not Ivy League schools notwithstanding, and private liberal arts schools not necessarily, but your major land-grant research universities, University of Kentucky, Indiana University, University of Michigan, 60 to 75% of courses are taught by adjuncts for undergrads. Yeah. For undergrads. And, adjuncts and graduate teaching assistants teach the bulk of the curriculum for undergrads, and they get paid next to nothing. I mean, it's really insulting if everybody out there listening didn't know what college adjunct professors get paid. It's pretty criminal. And yet we've got, like, at University of Louisville, our head basketball coach makes $7 million a year.
Wow. Yeah.
$600,000 a month.
That's crazy, man.
You start to think, what am I working for, a sports team or a university here? So I don't want to rant on it and get curmudgeonly like Tony, but it really is indicative of corrupt. Our society has just got warped priorities, and I'm sure I participate in it on some level. I don't think I'm pure as the wind driven snow or anything, but.
Well, you can't live outside the system. The system is what it is. I mean, we're all part of it. It's not like you can opt out, live off the land or whatever.
But right.
Like, what are you going to do as an adjunct to change anything? You know,
nothing.
it's a sad reality of life and education in every arena. Money. Yeah. The answer to all your questions is money. Jeez.
Well, we were talking about it in relation to how it corrupts ministry.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, just walking this morning, how politics gets corrupted by money. I mean, you've got, from my humble state of Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, who has hundreds of millions of dollars, and his wife is very, very wealthy as well. And he's a career, he's going senile before our very eyes, because he's so embedded in this corporate money that it's sickening. Like, you know, George Washington served as president kicking and screaming. He did. Yeah. He just wanted to go back to Mount Vernon and farm and live his life. he couldn't stand the actual idea of having to go and be on this political level. But oh my, how things have changed, you know.
Oh yeah,
just in every, almost everything you look at, it's a corrupting, money is the beast.
Yeah. Yeah, Mitch McConnell, who was not at all very wealthy when he went into the Senate back in the whatever, the 80s.
Right.
He's made a lot of money off of cutting deals. It's cutting really deals. Shady.
Yeah.
One of the most single-handed, when the story is told of the demise of the Republic, he'll be a major player in that story.
Oh, yeah.
The undoing of this whole thing. Oh, geez. Yeah. And his wife.
Elaine
Chao.
Man,
they would publish her on Twitter. People would publish her daily agenda, like what she was doing for the day. She hardly ever did her job. What was she, like, Secretary of Transportation? Who knows what she was doing?
Transportation Secretary. That's right.
Personal time.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, man. Senator Palpatine.
Jeez, yeah, I gotta apply for one of these jobs. That's what I should be doing. Yeah, right. It is interesting to look at the dynamics of money in all these different arenas. I mean, to say nothing of public education and how unjust that system is structured. Education, okay. Everything. Money just messes with motivations, and it is always a corrupting element. You know what's really sad is that there are baseball players who actually fall in love with their teams, or baseball players who are from a certain city and don't want to leave. But if they get offered a certain amount of money to go to another team or whatever as a free agent, there's some kind of deal with like the players' union where they, I don't know if they absolutely have to leave or if they have to take the money, but there's some kind of like felt responsibility to the rest of the players to actually leave just so that salaries keep climbing. So it's like, you know, I mean, as corrupt as professional sports is, you can't even have somebody have any kind of like team loyalty, which is really,
right,
really, really jacked up. And that kind of careerism creeps into, of course, ministry mindsets, where it's like you think in terms of like, I'm a youth pastor, and then someday I'll be a senior pastor, and then I'll get that big church, will offer me a position, you know, in town. Career ministry is seen as a career track, which just messes all kinds of motivations. I want to use stronger language, but it's so jacked up. Yeah. I mean, you and your choices, I mean, you sort of flew in the face of that when you got out of seminary back in the day and, chose a small church to just stay there instead of pursuing like a larger opportunity or whatever.
Yeah. Well, in hindsight, it's wild to think about, but
to think about what you saved yourself from.
Yeah,
I mean,
totally.
I no doubt it was hard, but
yeah, because you it's a real easy formula if you want to have a big dynamic church. If you're a good speaker and you're somewhat charismatic, it's easy. It's easy to do. And you remember there was a time where there's three guys who came to me with a lot of money, and they wanted to start a church. They had a lot of money. And they were like, hey, how about this as a salary, you know, in six-figure digits? I was making $10,000 a year.
Yeah.
And
a little Baptist church.
We'll buy land. We'll build a church. These guys are millionaires, all three of them.
Jeez.
And they wanted to be the controlling elders.
Yeah. Yeah. We want to own you, basically.
Yeah, we
want to
own you. And I got to say, it was tempting at the time.
Yeah,
I was working so hard, man. Had a used car that was breaking down. And I'm like, man, but then when I got to see, you know, talking with him, you know, just meeting with him, I was like, I don't like this one damn bit, Pagoda. It's like, these guys are trying to pull a fast one. They want me to be their spokesperson, their little talking
puppet.
Head. Yeah. Puppet. And I was like, God. And then, at that point too, I was just like asking myself, what's the New Testament talking about here?
I know it.
Sacrifice and all this. I'm like, oh, for crying out loud. But it's our culture, man.
Yeah, it is. And that is, it shapes everything. Dude, can you hear that motorbike? That motorbike only goes by when we're recording.
You know, it's one of your listeners that wants to mess you up, throw you off your game.
Yeah, this is a big day. The cultural realities of growth, which are everywhere, shape all of our conceptions of how we imagine church life. Like the way that we watch the news, if the housing markets are growing, that's good. We, our visage lifts, so my eyebrows go up, The housing market is slowing down. So like that's the economy's growing, economy's stalling. So that's how we think about everything. This ministry's growing, this ministry's stalling. And so we imagine doing anything and everything to get the church growing or to get the ministry growing or have my salary go up, all that stuff, man. It is so corrupting. And God, this guy wrote me yesterday, a guy that writes every once in a while, Sam, and he was asking about, you know, those commercials when we were watching the Super Bowl, those the ones about Jesus, he gets us. He was asking about that. And he mentioned like his suspicions about, the commercial aspect of things and sort of the impulse in evangelicalism to, which is a commercial reality. Evangelicalism is a capitalist. It's a capitalist form of Christianity. It's all about growth and popularity and money and all that kind of stuff. And it just seems like that's the same thing. It's just, buying commercials about Jesus.
Right.
And in addition to that, I don't even understand what the whole thing's about. I don't know. I didn't get the commercial. It didn't make it. I'm like, I want to sort of get it, but I don't really get it. Whatever.
Go on.
The culture that we grew up in is all about growth and popularity. Yeah. And when they were talking about that in relation to golf, it just makes me sad. I just don't want to hear that.
Oh, I know.
Whatever. Anyway, I got an email from a guy named Dan who a couple weeks ago, and he was wondering if we could talk about pedagogy and what our thoughts were on that. And I was thinking about, I don't even know, before I started teaching, I don't even know if I would have known what that term meant. But just about teaching and learning methodology. And I learned everything that I know about teaching on the fly. Did you have a class on pedagogy like in your PhD program?
No, never.
That's really interesting.
It was always, Well, for me, it was always, I had a number of professors that I just adored. Who were just magical to me. One of them, Michael Ryan, Dr. Ryan, if you're out there listening, which in the unlikely event, was the greatest professor I've ever had. He's a Marxist historian. I just loved listening to him. He was so well-read, articulate, with a vocabulary that you would not believe, like unbelievably articulate and eloquent, but also had that gift of just making you want to listen and just sucking you into what he could be talking about. Early Hungarian cabinet making, and he would make it interesting somehow.
Yeah.
And so I think, just on a broad general level, like not having courses in pedagogy, I would imitate what my favorite professors did.
Yeah.
That's a broad thing, but I mean, as a starting point,
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like, what kind of things did he do to make things interesting or to be a compelling teacher?
Well, his ability to communicate was like way up there, and to tell a story, And what I mean by that is he was teaching curriculum. He was a military historian, a European military historian. And he had a way, he had a gift. Well, it's just, I think it's basically just a storytelling gift. Like he could set up a story in a very compelling way that would want, that would draw you in, asking questions, a lot of questions, but with contextual inserts that would make you think, wow, what about that? You know? And, he was just very engaging. Like, the way he spoke, the way, and analogies, he would make analogies all the time that were right on, but could also clarify things. He was an early, gosh, I remember this. This is before, this is the early 90s. So computers were just coming on the scene. And I remember he was talking about the Gulf War, which I had just participated in.
Yeah.
Just a couple years earlier. Yeah. Two or three years earlier. And he rolled in this big cart. It's like now we all have, you know, touch screens and,
yeah,
you know,
totally
digital projectors and all this, and we just take it for granted. He's like, it, back then when I started, it was still chalkboards and erase boards. That was totally it. And so he rolls in this huge cart. He had to check out from the department, and it had a kind of big screen on the top. Yeah. And he's like, I'm going to try this CD-ROM enhanced version of the turning movement that was the big Gulf War takeover. Yeah. And I remember him showing it. And so he was already thinking about lots of different learning styles, visual learners, which I immediately connect with, cause I'm a visual learner more than anything else. And then, I don't know. He was always thinking about new ways to communicate information. Yeah. He wasn't one of those wah, 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 wah. Yeah. You're just like trying to stay awake.
Oh, dude. You know,
we've all had those, but just a very good communicator, unbelievably smart and well-read and articulate. So, yeah. I mean, that's really the core of it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I was thinking about, it's so funny. I was talking to Don one time about, cause this is what he does. You know, he did his PhD in education, did everything but, you know, his dissertation. Mm-hmm. And I remember, he ran the Center for Teaching and Learning, where I formerly taught. And I remember asking him, like, who really does need help, like, teaching? Like, are there, he's like, you would not believe. I mean, there are teachers who basically stand with their back to the classroom and do stuff on the board, or, you know, who like talk to the class with their eyes closed. I mean, I can't even imagine some like big brain math professor.
I've seen some of these in action.
That is so bananas, man.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Yeah, but I've had those that just march through material. Yeah. That's the goal of a class, is to quote unquote cover the material. And Don was actually a really big help to me this earlier in my teaching career. And he, I remember him saying that for a lot of these students, the information's out there. So in a classroom, you're not giving them information.
Right.
What you're doing is you're helping them how to think about the information. And that probably covers most of how I think about teaching, where it's like, if you can give people, give students like something to read in advance, or, you know, they've already sort of, you know, sort of plowed through material, or they've read something, and then you're going to sort of like raise questions about it, or help them process it, or even just let them in on the questions that you had about it, and just process it along with them. And then when I think back to like my favorite and most compelling teachers, like that's what they were doing.
Yeah.
You know, for however I agreed or disagreed with them, They're letting me know how they felt about it, their reactions to it, how they processed it, you know, and like, you know how it is. You've had those teachers that like the most interesting stuff that they say is when they've gone off on rabbit trails.
Yeah.
Because I never saw those as, okay, we're off topic. We're not quote unquote covering the material.
Yeah, me too.
It was like, all right, you're getting a window to what really pisses them off or to what really fires them up or what fires really, you know, they're matters. Really passionate about. Yeah, this is the stuff that matters. And you're getting, right. you're getting that window into how they process stuff. So right. I always felt really comfortable doing that, knowing that was not, you know, wasted time, but absolutely. that was really relevant. Because you're making connections, kind of like what you said about like you're drawing analogies and you're making connections and you're showing how this stuff, here's how this relates to that. Like what you've said about like the, you know, the drama among the gods in Greek ideology is not just information that's out there. It has everything to do with your family and your mom family. And your dad and how you see sibling rivalries. That's what it's all about. You know, and if you could draw those connections, you know, that's compelling. And then also those are like emotional realities that you can hang the quote unquote data or information on, you know?
Right.
And that's what makes people remember it.
Oh, for sure.
But
yeah, for sure. I think another thing I think when I think, how do I teach? Because you and I are similar, even though I never said it on one of your classes, but I just know from talking to you how we've talked for ad infinitum. I don't know how many hours we've spent talking about what we do. Yeah. We're both, I mean, the thing we've both done longest and most consistently is to teach.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, I'm going to go ahead and say it, toot our horns.
Toot them.
Look, I'm not trying to be, I don't think I'm great or anything, but I do know where I'm gifted and I know where I'm not gifted.
Yeah.
And you and I get the highest evals in our departments.
Yeah.
I mean, there's others that are up there with us, but we can teach. And I don't know, I think some of that is maybe just natural. Just you're born with some of that.
Yeah.
Just like I've always been told I'm a good storyteller.
Gift of gab.
But I also think along that line.
Yeah, you are. You're an excellent storyteller.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I am, and I think you are too. I'm a generalist as opposed to a specialist.
Yeah.
There's a great book. What was that book with Federer or Tiger or Roger or Tiger was the first chapter.
Oh, yeah.
It was, I can't remember the name of the book.
Killing me.
I'll get it to you and you can give it to your listeners. It's great. I'm just looking at my shelf. It's up there somewhere. I've got so many books. I got to get organized. Anyway, the analogy was that Roger Federer played a bunch of different sports growing up.
Yeah.
And became, you know, well, he's up, you know, one of the top three tennis players of all time. As far as if you're going to measure it by number of majors, he was surpassed recently, but he's all time great. Mm-hmm. Where Tiger was a specialist, he just all his life he knew the golf swing, and that's it. I mean, no other. In the classroom, I've noticed that we have some top notch world class scholars, researchers, who are specialists. And that's great. And they're big brained and they're more intelligent than I am. And, you know, on and on and on. But many times they cannot teach. Their students hate their classes and they get 1.7 ratings. And it's like, wow, how could you have that big a brain or have that much specialty? But I think it gets into the inability to make connections. And I've always thought, and some of this comes from research I've read, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's book called Creativity, which is an excellent book, New York Times. I think it was a bestseller. It was in some area. interviewed all these world-class people, and he said what he found almost every time of a real innovator, whether all different kinds of fields, was somebody who was very read widely outside their own discipline, mm-hmm. and in great depth, and didn't get siloed into just one yeah. field of thinking. So, you know, that's another thought I would have as to teaching versus, and, you know, there's another book, I can't remember the name of it, that was talking about the shift, and it was the early 1900s where teaching, like being a college professor, was a really highly respected, one of the highest respected vocations you could have within education. And then a change occurred 50s, 60s, where it shifted to research versus teaching.
Yeah.
To where you're just kind of going through the motions teaching, but if you can make big breakthroughs for your university, that's where the real sexy money is, and that's the real prestige is. And I just thought, that's too bad, because teaching is what we're there to do. But it's great to have researchers. That's super.
Yeah.
But, you know, kind of know your calling. And I think the great teachers I've had have been generalists versus super uber specialists.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've talked about that before, about how you and I are both creatives and not really pure intellectuals. So, right. I mean, there are contributions that we're not going to be able to make, because I just, doing some things just tires my brain out. Like I signed up for a project. Oh, I can't even believe I did it. I signed up for this project. God, what an idiot. I backed out of it, thankfully, because just thinking about it made my soul shrivel up. This project doing an exhaustive, a history of research on Paul's letter to the Romans, which, I mean, who can do that? It's just insane to think about who could possibly do it, but I know that it's not me. But I wanted to flex a bit and try to do a project that would really stretch me, and that would break me. Because that's just not the kind of thing that I could do, you know?
Right.
It would be like a landmark work, and I probably signed the contract out of ego more than anything else, and thankfully was able to back out of it. But so that kind of a contribution is just not something that I'm going to be able to do. But I know that, as far as like teaching wise, I can make those connections. I can let other people in on how I think through stuff, and that makes for a compelling classroom experience. And then, you know, so I do think that, naturally, you know, gifted teachers are just that. They're gifted. They sort of have a natural ability, and then combine mm-hmm. that hopefully with some kind of training, and just get a few, you know, get some tips on like pedagogical method and that sort of thing. Like when I first started, I mean, just to finish that thought, that makes for, I think, a really good teacher. When I first started, man, I had no idea how to put a syllabus together. I didn't even know what that was. I didn't even know, you got to have a plan for a semester, like with assignments and like an exam and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, certainly over the years, I've learned how to like flex as far as like, if you've got a section of 180 Intro to New Testament students, you've got to shape the class in a certain way. If you've got a seminar of 8, that changes. You know, you got to do something a little bit different. And then if you've got, you know, like you've done live classes, you've done online courses, mm-hmm. it's like you've got to shape the material and shape the learning experiences for each one of those. And they can all be great experiences. But anyway, just to say, it's been helpful for me to have a resource like Don. And now Maddie, it's funny because I'll ask her, my
it's
daughter,
hilarious.
Because this is what she does now at Arizona State. It's like, I'll text her. I'm like, hey, you got 5 minutes. You know, right. I'm like, here's what I'm doing. This is what I'm trying to do with this assignment. And she's just like, boom, boom, boom. why don't you do this? Why don't you ask them to do whatever, and then have a, here's how they can process that and submit it this way. And I'm like, geez,
yeah,
freaking genius, man.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But I mean, it's just amazing when you're to talk with people who just do that all the time and who have a real gift for it, like Don does, and have just endless resources at their disposal of stuff that they've thought through and learning experiences that they've created. It's interesting to talk to people like that, that have actually studied this and can offer all kinds of creative ideas.
Yeah.
Cause it's one thing if you've got the natural gift for it, but it's another thing if you're just a disorganized mess, you know, which I can tend to be.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Speaking of syllabuses.
Do you remember
that, like, there's a general basic framework for a syllabus in higher education in regular institutions.
Normal folks.
And they cover policy, they cover disclaimers, like Title IX.
All this stuff.
Do you remember what we had in seminary? Remember those things? They call them syllabuses, and they were like some of them.
Oh,
it was a competition like a to see how thick you could get one.
Like, it's like a measuring contest.
Oh Lord, why don't I just? Is this my classwork?
It's
just such a weird approach to a syllabus. I mean, it's like some of them were like 200 pages. Like,
I know.
I mean, I'm like, that's not a syllabus. I mean. My syllabus is usually 6-7 pages.
Yeah.
To cover what we're doing and when things are due, you know.
Yeah.
But
information. Good Lord. It's just the skeleton for the course.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So back to like effective learning strategies. I think a lot of what our professors were doing, because I think a lot of our professors were pastors that were just, you know, doing a little bit of teaching on the side for a couple extra bucks. And I remember one professor, it was like revealed. I remember sort of like seeing what he did and was like, oh my God. What he had pretty obviously did was whatever the course topic was, he had a book that he used and basically took that book's outline, you know, and just reproduced it in like note format. And, you know, the class was basically just walking through it. Just like, let's read through all these documents together. And as he just made point after point, and we just were like, oh yeah, okay, point A about this topic, point B. And even profs that we had with doctorates did very much the same thing. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
That was our quote unquote education. There was not a lot of reflection on, what kind of reflection pedagogically do you really need if you have the Holy Spirit? I mean, that's the anti-intellectual impulse. It's just like, you don't need that. We have gifted professors. So like, just
right.
Shut up and sit down and listen, because they know what the hell they're talking about and you don't.
You're just I know.
Fresh green seminoid that needs to get, you know,
indoctrinated.
Totally. If the mantle of gifting rests upon you, you'll have your chance sometime down the road. But for now, you listen up, son. Whatever. Not a good scene. Yeah, there's probably loads more to say about pedagogy, but I don't even think I've ever actually read a book about it. I think I've read sort of around.
Yeah.
I don't know, this guy Dan that wrote, he mentioned a book called like What the Best College Professors Do. I bet that would be something that would be good to read, but I just haven't read much about pedagogy. I kind of feel like I've learned some things. I know how to construct a. Whenever I put a class together, I just put a class together that is a class I would love to take. You know, like right. you and I have talked about our seminary class experiences. They were just, so many of them were just boring, just data dumps instead of compelling educational experiences. So like every time I make a syllabus, I'm like, well, if I'm taking a class on Intro to the New Testament or Ephesians or Romans, what do I wish I was taking? You know, because it's got to be compelling for me, or else I don't know. There's a lot of stuff that could be covered that I just don't care about.
Right.
And so I'm not going to foist that on somebody else. But
yeah, I for me, it's just, it's much the same, but also just imitating the great teachers I had. I mean, I had some really great ones, and I thought, man, what did they do that made me like totally perk up and get engaged and just try to, I don't want to say mimic it, but, you know, create a style that's like that, that draws you in and very interdisciplinary. I love, you know, my one, it's not, I don't know if it's a criticism, but like on Rate My Professor, like there've been some comments, man, he goes off on all kinds of different directions. I'm like, yeah, welcome to, my PhD is in humanities. It's interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's part of my job. Not staying in a silo, being trapped in one place, but
I think I feel like I've had to sort of settle with that as well. Like I know I'm not for everybody, and I know that there are certain learning styles that I'm just, that will just not get it. You know, there are students that come to class that want the information, and I try to satisfy them as much as possible. But I think there are certain kinds of like engineering sorts of students that I've had over the years that want the information. Like, what information do we need to have for the final? Well, all right, here's the information you need. But what I'm looking for is a sort of something more transformational,
right?
And to have an experience with all this that shapes us in a certain way rather than just sort of like gives us furniture in our brains or something like that. But
I think that by and large is exactly what kind of separates the sciences from the liberal arts. I mean, literature people, one of my other great teachers, John Alberti, literature professor, just could, God, it seemed like he knew everything. He could make any connection.
Yeah.
He could bring any analysis upon, from politics to economics to history. I mean, just so broadly capable of analyzing things. It just blew my mind.
That's the stuff that always gets me excited as well. I had a prof like that that would just, and literature, drawing in pop music, politics, I mean everything, making connections.
Movies.
That I mean, I just had that's the stuff that's just like genuinely compelling. So anyway, and I love questions and kicking stuff around and discussion. And when I was talking with Casey, whom you meet next weekend out in Orange County, when we were shaping what we were going to do for this year, I told him I was going to be selfish and like just do something that I'd want to do. You know, to create an experience that I would love to have, and to go through Luke's gospel in a way that I think would just be really exciting. And I know that will end up, you know, making a compelling experience for everybody, which I'm looking forward to. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Can't wait.
Yeah, man. So, dude, I'll see you Saturday.
All right. Looking forward to
it. Cool, man. Until then, enjoy the weather.